Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, one of my favorite guests, Stephanie Barba Hammer. Make sure you check out her new book, Pretend Plumber. It's a poignant book, and it's genuinely funny. Just do a search for Stephanie Hammer, Pretend Plumber. After my conversation with Stephanie about Arya's first POV chapter in A Clash of Kings, I rehearsed my three rules of dragon magic with comic Steve Osborne. Steve, as you may recall, is a stickler for magical rules, and so we will see if these rules hold water with Steve. Finally, a bit of housekeeping. I don't know if you've been keeping up with Andor. If you're like me, you've been somewhat disappointed with Star Wars of late. Andor is maybe the best thing I've seen since Empire Strikes Back. And the season finale just came out, so if you want to binge watch that, and then check us out over at the Lorehounds. I'm going to join the Lorehounds for the season wrap. So check out Andor and then check out the Lorehounds. All right, without any further ado, here is Professor Emerita of UC Riverside and one of my favorite authors, Stephanie Barba Hammer. Have we done an Arya chapter before, you and I?
We have not.
I think we did a Tyrion. I think we've certainly done Sansa a few times.
Oh, did we ever? Yeah. Got very heavy into Team Sansa.
Right.
For sure.
And now we are together again to talk about my favorite character, Arya Stark.
Wonderful. I didn't know she was your favorite character.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm delighted. And I have to say, as we start walking into this chapter, that she has become a new favorite for me on the basis of this chapter and on the basis of what I'm reading of Clash of Kings, which I'm really enjoying rereading.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just ask you, have you been keeping up with House of the Dragon?
I have.
How did you find that? Have you watched the whole first
I season? Have watched the whole thing and I'm now dipping into the behind the scenes series.
Oh,
So that reaction gives you already a little bit of a sense of what I'm feeling about this series. And I know there've been some very negative reviews of it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the New York Times says it's disappointing. Lots and lots of viewers are like, oh, what is this? I love it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Are you? Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great, because otherwise we would spend the whole next hour arguing about that when we need to talk about Arya. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. It's very different
from
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, what would you compare it to? Like, it certainly does not, I mean, it occupies the same world as Game of Thrones, but
yes,
both the tone and the long, epic time span, what would you compare it to?
Well, I think you've made a wonderful point about the tone. I agree. The tone and the emotional atmosphere, and indeed even the physical atmosphere, are very different from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this series feels more in keeping with the medieval literature that I've had exposure to.
Oh. Like
it's a little bit Beowulf-y.
Interesting.
It's a little bit Gawain and the Green Knight, mm-hmm. And I'm thinking not of the newish movie, but I'm thinking of the text itself.
Mm.
I'm thinking too of, oh gosh, Marie de France and her stories about the Middle Ages, which involve supernatural stuff. She has a wonderful story about a werewolf in her collection, and that combination of it is a brutal world in many ways. However, there are also very strong senses of loyalty, of actual courtliness, of actually playing by the rules, that that's still important in this world. Whereas for Game of Thrones, their rules, but...
Yeah, everyone was breaking. It was almost like an outlier to find a character who would play by the rules of court, right?
Exactly. Whereas the court and the whole sense of kind of, what do I want to say, of kingship and how kings are supposed to act, all of that seems to me to be taken very seriously in House of the Dragon. And I'm enjoying that. There's also some other people have said this. There's a certain Shakespeareanness to the conflict.
I was wondering about that. I was thinking every now and again there'll be something that is almost like a Shakespearean misunderstanding or a Shakespearean tragic unfolding of events.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not that you couldn't find those in the previous series.
And again, not a flaw in Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is more modern somehow in its contemporary situations put into this medieval kind of crazy world.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So one more question and then we'll jump into Arya. So do you find yourself more aligned with Rhaenyra's crew or with Allison's crew?
Team Rhaenyra all the way. Even though Damon's a bit of a problem, it's like, okay.
A bit of a problem?
He's going to be a tough husband to keep under control. Particularly when he tries to strangle you when he gets frustrated. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. But
I have thoughts about Team Black. But no, I don't. It's easy for me to sort of sit on the fence and judge both sides of the conflict, because I feel like every episode you're almost like, oh no, that guy's a monster. That guy's a bigger monster. Oh no, she's totally a monster. So it's a fun world to live in, an hour a week. You wouldn't want to live there full time.
No,
I don't think.
It's a nice place to visit for an hour, but you absolutely wouldn't do the extended tour, and you for sure wouldn't want to take up residence in any of those castles.
That's right. So let's talk about Arya. Arya's on the King's Road, and I'll read my little synopsis here in just a second, but she gets beaten at one point in this.
She does.
And it makes me think this could, you know, this could sort of be Martin throwing us back into an ancient culture. But I'm old enough that I can remember being beaten. I wasn't beaten bloody, but, you know, it's odd to me how recent some of these changes are, especially with children.
Yes.
Do you remember a beating that you suffered as a child?
Absolutely. I mean, beating is a bit of a strong word, but my parents spanked me. Absolutely. I mean, physical punishment was part of my upbringing.
Yeah.
I mean, it just was.
What was something that is especially memorable to you that warranted or resulted in a spanking?
Well, I remember this because my grandmother remembered it and used to talk about it, I think because she found it at once a bit funny, but also unacceptable. She was a lovely person. This is my maternal grandmother.
Okay.
My father had, I was very small. I was maybe 4 or 5. My father had some kind of surgery, minor, on his foot.
Okay.
And he had a cane, which I found fascinating as a child. It was like, oh, and I played with the cane. Mm-hmm. This is a little Arya-esque now that I think about it. And my dad told me not to play with the cane, and I kept on playing with it.
Oh,
and so he spanked me.
Right. It was too enticing not to play with the cane.
It was just such a neat thing. Yeah. And a little bit, you know, I was into fairy tales, so I was maybe thinking it was a sword. It's possible.
So, but he said not to play with it, and you did anyway. You probably did it in a sneaky way, and you got caught, or?
Yep.
Okay. Right. Yeah,
Don't play with the cane.
That is a little bit Arya. All right, let me read my synopsis. Arya is on the King's Road. Her traveling companions include various prisoners, all headed to the Night's Watch. Leading the group is Yorin, who has disguised her as an orphan boy. Two recruits in particular have taken an interest in Arya's uneven haircut, naming her Lumpy Head and or Lumpy Face. The one named Hot Pie tries to take Needle and is beaten bloody for it. This wins Arya an ally in the recruit named The Bull, but it freaks out Lommy Greenhands. Yorin punishes Arya with a beating of her own, then he tells her that Eddard was meant to be sent to the Wall. It seems that it was Joffrey's idea alone to execute her father. She continues to lean into the disguise, dreams of home, and misses Jon Snow. So, Stephanie Barbie Hammer, I've asked you to come up with an observation and or a question for discussion. What do you bring to the table today?
Well, what I'd like to bring first and foremost is a question for us to think about. In what ways does Martin show us that Arya has changed and evolved from the person that she was in the first book?
Do you mind if I start with some continuity?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Because this might help us with the process of elimination. I noticed that she still has Cereo Pharrell's advice echoing in her head.
Yes.
I noticed that, you know, swordplay continues to be part of her identity. You know, she will defend her possession of Needle. Like, you can do anything else. I'm not going to let you take Needle. She continues to love Jon Snow. One thing that I noticed, and maybe you can help me think through this, was it seems like she, prior to this, she was always defining herself over and against her sister Sansa.
Yes.
And it seems like now she's got bigger problems. Sansa used to be her biggest problem. And now
right. She
has actual, you know, rapers and poachers in the midst that she has to worry about. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a big deal. I mean, certainly she's now grieving the loss of her father. That's a major event in her life. Maybe that's the biggest one. Maybe I undersold. Yeah. I buried the lead, maybe.
But maybe not. I think your point about we're moving now into sort of the contrast into what's changed. That in particular, in one of the chapters that you and I discussed, we talked about Sansa versus Arya a lot.
Right.
And as I remember, Arya spills something on Sansa's gown.
Oh, I think she actually throws something.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the contrast between the sisters is so strong.
Yep.
And Arya's, I'm not Sansa. Who am I?
Yeah.
I am not Sansa. And it's so fascinating that Sansa is mentioned only very, very briefly in this chapter.
Yeah, interesting.
A few pages in, when Arya wishes that all of King's Landing would just wash away, that that the water would rise, mm-hmm. the rush would rise, I'm quoting here, the rush would rise and wash the whole city away, Flea Bottom and the Red Keep and the Great Sept and everything, and everyone too, especially Prince Joffrey and his mother. And then she stops. And this is such a wonderful example mm-hmm. of Martin's writing. This fantasy that is itself complicated.
Yeah.
And the fantasizer says, no, wait a minute, there's a problem with this fantasy. And it is, I'm quoting, but she knew it wouldn't. And anyhow, Sansa was still in the city and would wash away too.
Yeah.
So she says, oh, I don't want her to wash away. But in an ironic way, Sansa has been washed away because, as you just pointed out, Arya, who now has a couple of different names.
Yeah.
So important, the renaming that goes on in Martin's books, has bigger fish to fry than Sansa. So Sansa does kind of wash away and is no longer a part of things.
So it's interesting to me because I think that there's a sense in which if I'm reading a Sansa chapter, what I'm about to say is absolutely incorrect. But when I'm reading an Arya chapter, Sansa's the shadow almost functions as a cocoon that Arya needs to break out of.
Yeah, I love that.
From Arya's perspective, she's always lived in Sansa's shadow.
Yes. Yeah, always.
And now for the very first time, she doesn't.
Yeah.
Sansa's problems have parallels to Arya's problems, but they are geographically separated. Their problems are significantly different. You know, there's just a host of different problems and complications that they're going to have to figure out.
Yeah. And, you know, I love this thinking, because in subsequent chapters, Sansa is going to survive by really working feminine identity, and feminine identity as prescribed by this very sexist, very patriarchal culture. But she's going to work that identity for all it's worth, because as I pointed out previously, it's kind of all she's got.
Mm-hmm.
So because she isn't a swords person, she isn't a genius, that's what she's got, and she's going to work it. And here is Arya becoming, certainly assuming the identity for these other people, and perhaps assuming the identity in a different way, of a boy.
Ergo the name change. Yeah, for Sansa, it's almost like these men at court are not chivalrous. At least most of them are not. But most of them have to pretend to be, right?
Right.
And she knows that because she's read the stories. She's become an expert on what a good knight looks like. And once she figures out that they have to appear in certain situations to be chivalrous, she knows if I lean this way, they have to lean that way.
Yeah, particularly in public situations where there are a bunch of people present.
Right.
She can use that.
Right. This is what a woman at court has to figure out. Now, Arya, interestingly, is both transformed in social station, right? She used to be highborn, and now she's an orphan. Literally, she's she's been transformed. And then, of course, physically, she's been made to look like a boy, and she's been named a boy. And and her survival is about leaning into, you know, at one point, I think Hot Pie thinks that maybe she was a squire.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So he, fascinatingly, buys the boy identity, somehow senses that the class identity isn't right.
Yeah. That's right. And so she has to defend herself, not by, you know, playing a political game. She has to defend herself literally by beating her aggressor, right? She has to prove herself. It's like, it's almost like her first day in the county lockup, right? She's got to prove that she's not to be messed with.
That's right. It is. Well, she, of course, has been taken prisoner in a way, and there's some actual prisoners on the scene, locked up in the wagon. So the prison simile is not wrong. Or the boy's first day at the tough school.
Yeah, right. Sure.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Now, here's one difference that I'm noting. Sansa now does not have any adult who has her best interest in mind in the room.
Yes, that's true.
She has nobody. I mean, she might have people from time to time who, like, don't want to see her suffer. And, of course, Tyrion's on his way to court. And, of course, we would trust Tyrion more than we would trust someone else. And, you know, I'm not quite sure about the Hound yet, but he doesn't seem to beat her up like the others do.
Right, right.
Arya at least has Yoren looking out for her.
Yeah, right? She does.
So, I mean, she is probably more in danger of physical harm, but at least she does have an adult in the group that wants her best interests, wants to see her safely to Winterfell.
I think that's such a great point about isolation versus support. Mm. And of course, she has another ally in the making that we see, who we see come forward in this chapter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The bull. The bull.
The bull.
Who, of course, we later find out is the Baratheon bastard, Gendry.
Right.
It's one of those things where it's like, you know, on reread, it's pretty obvious that Martin wanted to drop a few clues to, you know, help you along. I did not pick up on this at all the first time I read it.
Yeah, I don't think I did either. Speaking of the kind of joys of rereading, something that I had fun doing, getting ready to talk with you about this chapter, is I went back and looked at chapter one in Game of Thrones, which is Bran going out for the first time, quote unquote, with his brothers and father to see the execution. So here he is bonding with his brothers, and it's the same chapter where they find the wolves, the baby,
right,
the pups.
That's right.
So there is Bran going off with his brothers. And again, this is what I love about Martin, is he's thinking macro and micro. Mm. There's a great parallelism with this chapter, because here's Arya, the baby girl of the family. Oops. Now a boy going off with the brothers who are going to be the brothers at the wall.
Well, yeah. And I think Yorn even calls it out. He says,
exactly. That's why she's beaten.
Yeah.
He says, you don't fight with your brothers. Uh-huh. You don't do that.
And she doesn't like that idea, but she holds her tongue. Right. She says
she does.
In her mind, she's thinking, those are not my brothers.
Yeah. But of course, Gendry does become a brother, and so does Hot Pie.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing about this that I was really interested in, and this, I don't, it's hard to know what Martin wanted to do with this, but it's almost impossible to read this chapter in 2022 and not think about a bit of gender bending. Right?
Absolutely.
So I'm curious, you've recently written a novel that I read and enjoyed called Pretend Plumber.
Thank you. I'm so glad you liked it.
And I remember that you have a character who almost by accident gets to try on gender fluidity. And correct me if I'm wrong, but your main character ends up being confused with a friend who is gender fluid.
who was trans.
Yeah, yes.
She gets, yeah, there's again, it's a comedy of errors, pretty much.
Right. And then she decides not to correct the misunderstanding because it's an opportunity for her to try that on for size herself.
Absolutely. And she's somewhat queer curious, so she figures I'm gonna roll with this and see where it takes me.
And then she almost feels a little guilty about it.
Right. Yeah. Yes, because she is borrowing she's borrowing an identity that belongs to a friend who is much less privileged than she is.
Right.
So she feels some and she's right to feel guilty about that. But it's a fascinating journey for her and hopefully for the reader to see this character say, well, wait a minute. You know, what's it like? What are the advantages to being seen and to moving through the world as a boy?
So it's almost like Sarah-Cine, because of the confusion, can not only try on how it feels, but also see how other people treat her differently. So it's almost
Absolutely.
Like the identity is both internal and it also has a social dimension, which of course we know that gender does have that performative element, right?
Yes.
And I wonder if that helps us think a little bit about Arya, because we know that from the previous book that she's almost envious of her brothers who have a different kind of freedom and a different kind of prospects for the future. So this isn't the first time that Martin's introducing this gender questioning that
Yes,
Arya is experiencing.
Absolutely. And I think you make a great point that in the past, Arya has felt tremendous frustration at being a girl.
Right.
Well, in a ironic and very dark way, she is now getting her wish to not be a girl. She is getting to be a boy. She's a boy without a penis.
Right.
But which causes certain issues in terms of peeing and peeing in public.
Right.
But she does get to be a boy.
Yeah. She doesn't choose it. It's not like this thing is absolutely forced on her. And it's to save
yes.
her life. You know, Yorn has this idea. The best way to save this kid's life is for me to cut her hair, call her boy really loudly. And they're going to let me, you know, walk right up to Winterfell with this child hiding in plain sight. And Yorn, of course, is not trying to give her a gift except for just to save her.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think if you were to ask Arya, would you rather have your father back or have the opportunity to have your hair cut? She's absolutely going to keep her father around, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And yet because of this, she's forced into a role where she now can act in certain ways that she could never act before.
And to be honest, it's a role for which she is not unprepared, thanks to Master Serio.
Yeah, sure. And Ned, you know, Ned.
And Ned.
Yeah.
And John.
And John, right.
Who gave her the sword. Uh-huh. And again, let's not get too Freudian with the sword, but still, one can think a little bit about that fight with Hot Pie as to who's the real guy here.
Uh-huh.
Who's the manlier man here? And she is.
Well, it's interesting. So if she was a girl in this socially, if she was a girl socially in this situation, she might have to give up Needle just because girls aren't supposed to play with sharp
exactly.
objects, right?
Exactly, yes.
Now because she's a boy socially in this situation, she can keep that thing as long as she can defend herself.
Right.
As long as she is, as long as the person that's trying to take it away from her isn't bigger and stronger, she can keep it around. And she does.
Yeah.
She does keep it around for a long time.
Yes, she does.
So it's almost like, I mean, I think there is something to be said about the sword being an identity marker for her. You know, it connects her to Jon. It connects her to Winterfell.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Much, much later when she's in the House of Black and White, she's supposed to kind of cast off her ego, but she hides the sword.
Yes.
She's not willing to give it up, right?
Absolutely. That's a wonderful point. And yeah, it's the... I remember reading that section for the first time and going, oh, I didn't want her to give up the sword. And I'm so glad she doesn't. But yeah, that is again, mixing metaphors, the bedrock of her identity. You can't see me, but I'm pretending to hold a sword. It's it's not just masculinity. It's the family. Uh-huh. It's her father. It's an identity larger than just herself.
It is steel that was forged at Winterfell. So it has the same birthplace as she does. Yes. It was given to her by her favorite brother, who I think she has the strongest connection to.
Yes, and we see that certainly at the end of the chapter.
And because Ned finds it and lets her keep it, that initiates her first training with Syrio, right?
Correct.
So it really is her origin story. I mean, we've traveled with her and that sword the same amount of distance. Anyway, I just think it's lovely writing. There is a couple other little bits of this chapter that that I think connect us to the wider story. But I want to know before we get to those, is there anything else about Arya in particular?
I think the other observation, I'm thinking point, you know, we've been talking about swords and points, so let's not use the word point for a moment. But the other moment in this text that I think is so wonderful and that shows us, sure, continuity, but also considerable evolution in terms of the skill set of this person is the actual fight with Hot Pie.
Okay.
Which is, again, as a writer, I so admire writers who can write action scenes. Action scenes are so hard to write because it's all action. It's physical. So how do you use words to demonstrate and make us feel, make us share what's happening? And the description is just fantastic.
Do you mind if I read it?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Arya slid her practice sword from her belt. "You can have this one," she told Hot Pie, not wanting to fight. "That's just some stick." He rode near and tried to reach over for Needle's hilt. Arya made the stick whistle as she laid the wood across the donkey's hindquarters. The animal hawed and bucked, dumping Hot Pie on the ground. She vaulted off her own donkey and poked him in the gut as he tried to get up, and then sat back down with a grunt. She whacked him across the face and his nose, and made his nose crack like a branch breaking. Blood. I shouldn't be laughing. This is violent, right? Blood dribbled from his nostrils when Hot Pie began to wail. Arya whirled toward Lommy Greenhands, who was sitting on his donkey, open mouthed. "You want some sword too?" she yelled, but he didn't.
It's great. And I just want to stop for a second because we both laughed.
Yeah.
Because there's something, again, this is the genius of the author. There's something a little Three Stoogesy about it.
It is a little bit.
You know, crack.
Yeah.
And the falling on the ground. And of course, they're on donkeys, which is also funny.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're not on steeds. They're not on stallions. They're on donkeys. So, and when Hot Pie began to wail, he's this big guy who said, "I killed somebody, I'm awful, I'm so bad," and he immediately starts to cry.
Yep, yep.
So there is a little bit of comedy there for sure.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the stakes are somewhat lower because we know this is a practice sword. So it's not like, you know, we saw a horrific interaction that Arya had at the end of the last book.
Yes.
She ends up killing someone.
Yes.
She's on the run. She's afraid for her life. And she ends up stabbing a boy in the stomach.
She kills him. She's a murderer.
Yeah. It's an absolute. And she's a little bit, you know, she's certainly feeling guilt about it.
Yeah.
She mentions it here in this chapter. Yeah. She doesn't want to tell Yoren that she's done this. But she kind of knows I have something in common with these men that Yoren dragged out from the Black Cells.
Right. She keeps on looking at the guys and the three really scary guys. She keeps looking at them, perhaps recognizing a little bit of herself in them.
Yeah, I think so. And she's not quite comfortable with that. This is kind of she's taken her first steps toward this death religion.
Yes, true.
She's not, we don't have her reciting her list yet, but you kind of see the seeds of that. She's named Joffrey as sort of the person that's most responsible for Ned's death.
Yes.
So
the list is forming.
Yeah, the list is forming for sure. We have at least one name. A couple other things that I really enjoyed about this, and I'm reminded from time to time, even though these chapters are divided by point of view, that you can really reveal a lot about a character from someone else's perspective.
Yes.
I felt like I'm reading this first chapter of this book, and I find myself missing Jon Snow. You know, she misses Jon Snow. They haven't seen each other in, you know, 700 pages or whatever. But my mind is cast up to the wall, and my mind wonders what's happening with Jon Snow. Even though this is all about Arya and Arya's plight, part of her identity is wrapped up with Jon. And every now and Martin will do that. He'll insert a bit of information about a different character that you haven't heard from in a while in someone else's POV chapter. And
oh, that's very interesting. I hadn't noticed that, but you're right. He does do that.
Because you could get so wrapped up in what's happening on the King's Road that you're not, you know, you might lose track of and maybe lose investment in what's going on up north of the wall or something.
Right. Yes, it's such a clever maneuver. And it's also so fascinating because I think it hooks into the questions that Martin is asking throughout the series. And that is, what do we owe others? And what is our relationship with others? Hmm. And what can our relationship with others be in this very violent, corrupt world? What's possible? Hmm. And certainly the figure of John keeps on coming in as, ironically, though he's taken the black and lives in a very dark world, is this kind of moment of light. Because he really genuinely loves Arya, and Arya genuinely loves him. It's really a beauty. And of course, he isn't her real brother. Back to who's my brother.
Right.
He's not her real brother, but she has real kinship with him.
And I think that there's something about her found family along the road. You know, she's lost her family, but Yorn is kind of a stand-in for her father, and she's got a big brother in the Bull. And
yes.
Then she's got a couple, you know, mean brothers in Lommy and Hot Pie. And they are specifically called her brothers.
Yeah. And then, of course, hiding in that cell of the wagon is another brother slash father figure slash instructor.
Hey, you're right.
We just don't quite. I love how he gets inserted with just kind of in that panorama of people and wagons. There he is, jockin'.
Mm-hmm. There he is. Right. And then, of course, that also is, you know, planting the seeds for the House of Black and White.
Yes.
I wanted to talk a bit about the comet.
Yeah, let's do it.
One of the things that Martin has done in these early chapters is he keeps introducing the comet. And I think it tells us a little bit about each person's, I don't know, interpretation. It reveals something about their character.
Absolutely. Yes.
So Arya here sees the comet and thinks it's probably what ice looked like when it had Ned's blood on it. Right? It's a sword. It's a sword. It's the sword that beheaded my father. And that tells me something about Arya's interior, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also serves to connect the other characters in the story that, you know, in Maester Cressen has an idea about what the comet might mean. And,
right.
And he tells us what, you know, what people are saying on Dragonstone. You know, what are the commoners saying? And then in the chapter after this, we hear the comet propagandized. Like, you know, this is a sign and a portent in honor of Joffrey's name day.
Right. It's the Lannisters.
Yeah, it's the Lannister red, right?
Yeah.
So again, it's almost like a little literary trick to reveal something about the character at the same time unifying these early storylines because they're all looking up at the same cosmic event.
And right? Seeing something so different, each one of them.
Yeah. It's like a Rorschach test.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was really struck by that also. And I want to come back to a point that you made earlier, Anthony, about the continuing importance of Eddard Stark's death, that it really was this traumatic experience. No surprise there. So what do we do when we undergo a traumatic experience that we can't really bear to think about directly? We displace it in certain ways.
Right.
So she makes that scene into the comet, and the sword that kills him is the comet, and so on.
Right.
And it'll be interesting to see how she manages that kind of unbearable memory going forward.
Yeah, we're told that she cried repeatedly, and then we're told that by morning she was all cried out, like she had no more tears left. You almost feel at the beginning of the chapter that she's steeled herself. She's created this tough exterior because now she has to forge ahead. But when we're introduced to the comet at the end of the chapter, we realize it is absolutely still part of how she's experiencing the world, right?
Yes, absolutely.
She's all cried out, but she's not done with that trauma yet.
Right, not at all.
What a beautifully written and complicated character.
Say a little bit more about why she's your favorite. I'm interested.
I feel so vexed when I'm rooting for Arya, because in so many ways, she's on a trajectory to darkness, to death. She's on a trajectory toward either emptying her ego in an interesting way or embracing her ego in an interesting way. I mean, her story is so brutal, you know.
It is. It's very brutal.
It involves, you know, it involves sex work in Essos. It involves traveling with the Hound and him teaching her, like, what are the best ways to kill a man? You know, that this is kind of her mentorship along the way.
Right. And she's a little kid. She's 9 years old, in this chapter. I mean, oh, my God.
And so I'm always rooting for her. I always want to root for her to succeed. And at the same time, there is part of me that thinks the more she succeeds, the more of a vengeance monster she becomes.
Yeah.
And this brings me to all kinds of complicated feelings about, you know, what I really want for this character. I mean, part of me wants someone to just scoop her up, bring her to Winterfell and protect her, right?
Yes,
and yet,
indeed.
That's not a satisfying story.
No.
For her, anyway.
No, it isn't, actually. It isn't.
So,
as you're talking, Anthony, I'm thinking about the many times in history and in the present child soldiers have been used for in terrible wars and in terrible terrorist acts. Kids Arya's age get used. And I feel scared for her always as I read about her. And at the same time, I feel such tremendous admiration for her because these sets of experience would lay out most people. And she has, I'm looking at the words Valyrian steel. She's the Valyrian steel. She's really, really an incredibly strong person.
And the reason, part of the reason why she's so strong is, you know, because she's Ned's daughter and she's Kat's daughter, right? But part of the reason she's so strong is that she's separated from Ned and she's separated from Kat. You know, she's had to deal with tragedy, and that this has made her stronger and made her more lovable, right? I feel like I've really come to love her.
Oh, I think she's lovable too. I also think, as you're talking, you mentioned Jon Snow earlier. The other thing about Arya is from the very beginning, she is an outsider. She's the biological child of her parents, unlike Jon Snow, but she doesn't fit.
Yeah, the very first line of this is like, she used to be called Arya Horseface.
Right.
And that she thought was the worst it could get, right?
Yeah.
But so she's always been a little bit of that outsider, right?
So it's kind of the book is in an odd way. The books are in odd ways celebrations of outsiders.
Yeah,
because she is the person who doesn't fit. She doesn't want, she, as we've already talked about, she doesn't want to be a girl. She doesn't want to do girl things. So ironically, she calls her sword Needle, which is, of course, an instrument that women use in this world. And, but she's going to use, this is a very different kind of needle to do a very different kind of sewing or unsewing in her case. And she's always at odds with her surroundings. Now she's really at odds with her surroundings. But I agree with you, because of her parents, and also we've been talking a little bit about our own children, because of her own qualities that are hers, is somehow able to survive all of the things that are happening to her.
And I think that there's something about Arya that reminds us about the plight of children in Martin's world in particular. You know, we know that Varys is using child spies to do dirty work.
That's right. Yeah.
And we know, you know, there's a lot of places in this world where children are not allowed to be children, right?
They're
absolutely
not
used to do dirty business. And now one of Ned Stark's kids, who you'd think, you know, would be well protected and, you know, have a charmed life, now one of these kids is being treated like a lot of other kids are being treated in this world.
That's a wonderful way to think about these books. We've been talking a lot about gender in this conversation, but really the power struggles between children and adults, that's really an important issue in all of these books.
Right. And I think that that's one of the ways that sort of makes this world alien to us, is that, and this was actually true once upon a time in our own world, is that a 14-year-old could be a king, right?
Yes. A 12-year-old could be a king.
A little girl could get married off before puberty. I mean, this was the world that, you know, that our own culture kind of discarded, right? We don't, in favor of childhood, we didn't want that.
Right.
But Martin's world, it's pretty common. It's pretty common to find a kid who has legitimate political problems or legitimate political power. And of course, this also attracts all sorts of different kinds of adults in their orbit, right?
Yes.
Introducing in this chapter, Lommy Greenhands and Hot Pie and the Bull and the three prisoners, which you mentioned, one of whom is Jack and Hagar, but we not named yet. We also have an introduction to several of Arya's names. She's a character with just dozens of names, right? So we heard about Arya Horseface before, but now she's called Ari. This is the first time we hear the name Ari. And then, of course, Lumpy, both Lumpy Head and Lumpy Face are introduced in this chapter.
Right. I was really, again, as a writer, so thrilled by Jaqen not named appearing.
Yeah, of course.
With these other two.
Uh-huh.
I just thought, now that's a slick way to introduce a quite important character.
Show differences. I noted that Arya doesn't really get beaten by Yoren in the show.
In the show. I haven't looked at that this season recently.
Yeah.
But that corresponds to what my memory was also.
Yeah, and Hot Pie takes it. Hot Pie gets it really badly. I mean, Arya really, really gets him. Nothing like that happens in the show. You know, Hot Pie kind of gets put in his place, but nothing like what we see on the page. And of course, you know, at that point in the show, we absolutely don't want to see a little actress Arya, you know, getting beaten bloody in the woods to teach her a lesson.
That's so interesting, Anthony. Do you think that the show, the television series, holds back a bit from violence at directed against children?
I think it depends on the kind of violence we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they wanted to lean into the father figure part of it for Yoren.
I see.
Like,
yes.
Another show difference is that in the show, Yoren teaches Arya about, like, there's a little story invented about his backstory. Like, someone killed his brother, and then he created in his mind this revenge fantasy. And that's how Arya gets the idea to have a death list. She gets that from Yoren. Yoren is really a father figure, and I think it's hard for a modern audience to be happy with a father figure who's going to use corporal punishment.
Right. That makes sense.
That's my sense of it.
I was just wondering, because certainly the television show does not hold back from sexual violence against women.
That has been well discussed.
Well documented and well discussed. But yeah, it's interesting that it holds back in this area. Fascinating.
Yes. And then notable departures. I guess we could say that this group has departed from King's Landing. In fact, Arya in the books will never go back to King's Landing, as far as we can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Although she will create a death list, and a few of the people that she wants to kill are in King's Landing. So,
yes, indeed,
we'll see how that plays out.
We will.
Steph, if people are interested in checking out Pretend Plumber, where would they go?
They can go to that big megaplex online that sells a lot of books. They can go to Amazon, or you can order it from your favorite bookseller.
Okay, fantastic. And I also, I should mention also, you've got a new poetry book out, City Slicker.
I do. Very lacking in any kind of violence. It's a memoir in poems, free verse mostly, about my experiences with the out of doors. I'm a New York. I grew up in New York City.
Okay.
So the out of doors has always been a somewhat exotic place to me.
I'm guessing you have maybe a fraught relationship with the outdoors.
Somewhat fraught, but also fun.
Okay, good.
It depends.
Good. All right. Well, I'm sure that a number of our listeners will want to check those out.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne. All right, so the other fan theory that I really liked for a while is Arya meets these three gross guys in a cage.
Right. Yes,
right. So these guys are Jaqen H'ghar. He's the nice, handsome one. The others are Rorge and Biter. And
okay.
Well, you know, one of them has sharpened yellow teeth. What else are you going to call him, right?
He sort of lose being called Doug.
he was Doug until he started sharpening his yellow teeth. And then
he's like when Sting just told everybody he's Sting now. He's like, I'm Biter now. Check these out.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, as a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Steve, what's the worst you've ever been bit, or the worst you've ever bit someone or something else?
And we're talking not food. I mean, I've bitten forks. Like, you ever do that? You ever like go, oh, I don't know how to eat today.
The fork is like sideways for some reason.
Yeah. You just like chomp right down, like miss the food altogether.
I'm thinking like, I don't know if this brings to mind anything, if you ever were in a fight or if an animal ever attacked you or something like that.
No, so like we have, you know, a myriad dogs. One of our more recent puppies, like just, you know, I just was sitting there and kind of petting him. And then he took a look at my finger and he just started biting on it as hard as he could. And I had to like pry his mouth up because I thought he was just going to snap in half.
Huh. All right.
Yeah.
This is Bender.
This is Bender.
Yeah. Yeah, so you think that might be the worst you've ever been bit?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like, oh, like, I mean, if he didn't think to stop or if I didn't stop him, it could have just snapped it right, you know. Uh-huh. That's so that was definitely, because I don't think I get bit often.
I was just thinking, we just covered Teen Wolf 2 over at Cocoons mm-hmm. of Horror, That is a werewolf movie that is has no biting. There's not a single bite in the entire movie.
No. Yeah, they're no biting. No.
I mean, I guess he does bite a frisbee at one point.
He bites a frisbee in midair. Does he even claw or scratch?
No, he gets. He definitely gets.
He squeezed the tush, but it wasn't like he scratched at it.
No, that's right. He squeezed the tush. He also like really devours those science books.
Yeah, he is. He's taking a bite out of knowledge.
It's an odd choice for a movie featuring a werewolf.
Yeah, like the big montage is a studying montage.
So, post House of the Dragon, we've had a lot of discussion about when dragons obey, because of course, you know, you got Eric's and Luke getting chomped specifically because Vhagar is not choosing to obey his master.
Right.
So this kind of reminds me of a long discussion we had back when we were covering the original series about the rules of magic. So you really needed those rules in order for you to kind of invest in a world with magic.
Yeah, I mean, because you can, if you have no rules and just magic, you know, magic abounds and it's like, oh, well, you know, this is a tough situation. I wonder how they're going to get out of it. It's like, oh, good thing there's magic.
So given this discussion, I've come up with three rules about dragon magic. And I want to, I know that you are a stickler when it comes to the rules of magic. I feel like if I can get these past you, if I can get your quality control on these three rules, then I feel a lot better about them.
Okay.
So this kind of emerged for me when I read this quote by George R.R. Martin, who you may have heard of.
But yeah, in passing.
Yeah. So he gave this interview. He said, "You have to bond with the dragon. There's no way that you can physically intimidate a dragon to obey you. If you just annoy the dragon, he'll just turn his head around and roast you or bite you in half." And we did see some biting in half.
Indeed.
He says, so it takes something more than physical force. It takes a kind of psychic bond. And the precise nature of that bond is something that I'm still exploring in the world of Ice and Fire. So as of the giving this interview, which is about 3 years ago, I don't think that he's fully come up with the necessary rules for dragon magic. But I think in this final episode, we do see something of a psychic connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between Rhaenyra and her dragon when she's giving birth.
Right. I like that he phrases it as like he's like exploring it, right? Like he's
he has no idea.
It's like I mean you could just do it. That's the magic.
This is the thing that's holding
the writing. The magic of your imagination.
Well, I mean, I think if I was gonna be a little snippy about it, I'd be like, this is what's holding you up, isn't it, George? You haven't figured this out yet.
Yeah.
Once you got this figured out, you're gonna finish these books. Yeah. But if I was going to be a little bit more generous, I would say I think this is probably what makes him stand apart as a writer. Like, you know, he really will give this a lot of thought. And I think that you appreciate it when the author has given the rules a bit of thought, you know.
Yeah, and I'm being cheeky, of course. I think it is. I like the idea because, like, when you create something, you create a world, right? And like, there's a sense of artistic, like almost voyeurism as you're in your own work, right? You get to a point where you're like, oh, this is sort of taking on a life of its own, and like, you think you have an idea and maybe the art takes you in a different direction. I like to say often, you know, art creates the artist, not the other way around. And so you have a situation where it's like, well, I've created this. And like, now what may have made sense. And if I just sat in a room in a vacuum and said, I'm going to create the rules of dragon ownership. Mm-hmm. And then you go, well, how does that work now that in this context of this world? Yeah. And is that even the story I want to tell anymore? You know? So that's, I think actually the way he puts it is a great way to put it.
Okay. So I like this, and this got me thinking, well, if he's still developing these rules, I'm just going to go with like what I know about the dragons in his world, what I've seen on screen, and I'm going to come up with my own rules for my own headcanon. So I'd like to run
So if you're listening, George, we'll do the heavy lifting for you. Here come your rules for
just
magic.
Just in case this
dragons.
Was the only thing that was holding you back from Winds of Winter.
Right.
I think
he's
going
combing through podcasts, going through everything. And eventually, after listening to our Teen Wolf 2 review, he says, I wonder if they have any other podcasts.
Sure. Okay. This is Anthony's rule about dragons, number one. Dragons are beasts of war and conquest. I think that is very well established in this world. These are creatures that, they're not pets. They're fire made flesh. They're there for war. So they're beasts of war. And this is one of those times where it's like, can you ever really root for a Targaryen who's bonded with a dragon? Because let's imagine a guy that's just carrying around a nuclear bomb. Like, are you really ever going to root for that person?
So you're saying that these are one track
yes.
animals, that's right. that they cannot be tamed, that there's no such thing as they can breed them down.
I think that they...
Or you have teacup dragons. Can you have a teacup dragon that you carry around in a purse?
I think that you might. However, that teacup dragon is absolutely going to Dracarys a cat at some point. And you can't just shrug your shoulders. You can't just say, I'm sorry, I didn't know it was going to happen. You knew it was going to happen. That's what dragons do. They dragon you.
Can't you get a teacup dragon to just be there to Dracarys your stogie?
Nope. And that brings us to rule number two.
Maybe you want a little creme brulee.
This brings us to rule number two. All right. So I don't think that there's a taming part of this. I think that there's a bonding part of this. So this is Anthony's rule about dragons number two. If you are bonded to a dragon, the more warlike your command, the more likely the dragon will obey. The less warlike the command, your dragon might obey and he might not.
Gotcha. So like, roll over.
Yeah, he might not
dead.
Do it. He
not,
might do
not
it.
Super
he may
interested.
Not. You're not super yeah. interested. So, I mean, it could be like, you want him to do a loop-de-loo, and he's like, yeah, I'll do that. That's but or he might feel like, yeah, not today. I don't feel like it.
So it might be like, yeah, I'll do the loop-de-loo if it helps this battle.
Yeah, right. Right. So, yeah. So rule number one, these are creatures of war, right? They're like, they're made for one thing. Number two, because they're creatures of war, you can bond with it. And the dragon may obey your will, but you're more likely to get the dragon to obey if you are commanding it toward battle aggression. That's my rule number two.
Okay.
All right. So this is rule number three. This is Anthony's rule about dragons. Number three, a psychic link with a dragon makes the rider more violent.
Oh.
The stronger the link, the more warlike the rider becomes.
So sort of that becomes symbiotic, right? So like, hey, yeah. the dragon wants to be used for war. It's going to be more inclined yeah. to follow instructions of war, yep. and you will also be more inclined to give it. You'll give it what it's asking
yes.
for.
And I think that this is, it's crucial to make the distinction between bonding and taming here. So if you tame a dog, the dog will now view you as the alpha or whatever and want to please you or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When you bond with a dragon, I think it's more like, now you have my feelings and I have your feelings, but we are now both kind of creatures for war at this point. And I think that this might explain why the most dragony guy in the whole show, Daemon, is also a very violent character. And why Viserys, who is sort of always dragon dubious, becomes the king of peace, right?
Okay.
And I think it might also explain some of Dany's turn in the later parts of the narrative.
Oh, interesting. I like that. I like that. I think it also, to some degree, explains why Elliot feels drunk when E.T. is drinking a beer at home.
Because
are we tracking? Is that
E.T.'s a creature of addiction? Is that what
E.T.'s the villain?
very good. I like it. So those are my three rules, and I'm just I would like to, I'd like you to kind of Give them the once over. Do these strike you as plausible?
I mean, yeah, sure, right? I mean, so that's when you have the final sequence where Vhagar does what Vhagar does. I mean, like, maybe that's like, ah, I'm a call an audible here, because this is you're playing around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to taunt. I'm here to chomp.
Yeah.
You commanded me
to chase this kid. Mm-hmm. I'm all about that. I'm all about doing high wire flying battles. I'm a dragon. That's what I like to do.
Yeah, not to tease.
Yeah, no. And then, of course, he says no. Like, both of the dragons disobey, right?
Right.
So the dragons decide that they're going to do dragonish things high above the clouds. They don't know how to pull back. I mean, and it's not just that they don't know how to pull back. It's that that command wasn't warlike. You know, once I go to battle, I'm in battle. You know, and I think that there's something almost to be
doesn't,
said there.
It almost doesn't compute at all to sit there and say, well, no, now do you're asking now to deny instinct. Mm-hmm. You can only harness instinct. You can't remove it, right?
I'm saying that the first instinct of the dragon is to attack. And so if you ask a beast of any kind to like do what their natural instinct is to do, they're probably going to want they're more inclined to do that thing, right?
Right, right.
So I guess the other thing is that the other way that you can look at this,
like when you're dealing with Tony Danza, right? Like, so when you're dealing with Tony Danza and you want him to act, but his instinct is to tap dance, right? And so you have to find a way to incorporate tap dancing into the acting, because that's what he's going to want to do. And he's going to be like,
if you don't know that as a director going in, then why are you working with Tony Danza?
Right. And that's what was so genius about Who's the Boss. Because, yeah, no, he did not tap dance in every episode. But every single episode has a tap dancing scene that they edited out, because that's how you get him to do what he does. You have to let him tap his way through it. If you look at some episodes, there are like moments where you can see the edit where like he's a little sweatier in the scene than he should have been in the scene previous. That's because he just tapped.
So there's a question between, is the writer the boss or is the dragon the boss? And I think that's the right question to ask. We should be asking who's the boss in this.
Yeah, well, and that's really, I mean, I don't know if we were at the premiere, so a lot of our friends and listeners don't know this, but they really said that season one is almost a shot-for-shot remake of the first season of Who's the Boss.
Rhaenyra's Angela, is that what's happening?
Right, yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, those are my rules. And I think that, you know, keep an eye. We'll see if these rules pan out. I mean, I'm not married to them, but I do think that they do explain a little bit of like Daemon's behavior. They do explain a little bit, and it might explain Dany's behavior. I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah, no, I like how that sort of ties that together. Right. Yep. I mean, if it does sort of help. Especially if people were like not really sure about the like, well, why the turn, right? And it's like, well, it suggests it's more than just like, oh, it's in their blood, right? Like it actually take the magic in this case actually creates a more logical explanation.
Yeah, and I think that they like the latter seasons they were really leaning into like, hey, you know, it's a kind of a coin flip with these Targaryens, and what I'm saying is maybe it's not a coin flip. Maybe you can track who is warlike with who's bonding to a dragon. I mean, look at Aemond. Aemond bonds with Vhagar, the oldest and baddest dragon there is, and immediately he gets off the dragon, and he goes and picks a fight with his cousins.
Yeah, that's true. So then it'll be interesting, too, to find out, like, how many dragons can you bond with, right? Because I think that's what we're seeing with Daemon, is he's got a bunch of dragons. Sure. Like, does that give you the ability, like, so that would create a situation now where if we follow your rules, like, is he able to bond with multiple dragons in a way that's sufficient, or is that like, does it become even less control because you can't have like a full bond if it's multiple dragons? Or does it go the other way and say, look, if you're sort of absorbing that warlike tendency, now you added more dragons to the mix, does that make you less of maybe start stripping away any of your, peaceful or even compassionate, abilities, because you're now just, you become more of a creature of war.
And I think that there's I don't think this is perfect. I think that like Rhaenys would be an example of someone who she seems to be cold and calculating and thinking about the long term. Like, she does not seem warlike to me. She's bonded with a dragon, and she's not very warlike. So, I mean, she does kill, you know, 200 or so commoners with her dragon on one,
which feels,
one of the episodes.
Which feels like a war thing.
It's a little bit warlike, for sure. I mean, she's a mass murderer. There's, you know, there's no doubt about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and that tends to be a thing that happens in war.
Okay. Anyway, she does seem like someone who can pull a punch if she wants to.
Well, but keep in mind, like, but again, like we just talked about, it's like if the command is don't attack because that's not the best strategy for this particular
right.
battle, that's still coming from a place of war, right? It's coming from a place of violence, but it's more calculated.
Yeah, whereas and then I think she said in the next episode, she said, yeah, there's going to be a war. There's no doubt there's going to be a war.
Mm-hmm.
The question is it my war to start? So
right, and whereas Aemon's command to stop was not like stop because we're going to go fight another day. It was just like, well, I don't have any intention of doing this.
Yeah, I don't really want this kid dead. Anyway, that's what I got. That's all I got for you.
Well, that's exciting. That's a very exciting thing to think about.
I think so too, and I feel like I ought to go watch a couple episodes of Who's the Boss just to
yeah. Just to see how it all, because I mean, well, don't watch too far.
I do want to see if Tony Danza plays by these rules or not.
Right. Well, that's the trick, right? I mean, like, he's a bit of a dragon himself.